nine times out of 10, when someone is taking the time to break away and do their own thing, it's because they either have a specific point of view or a specific passion that really sort of speaks to maybe not a mass audience, but the customers that I have and the customers that Barterhouse tries to culture and cultivate, I think are those type of people who want that story and feel like if they take an allocation of an 80 case made wine, that they've got something special and it's something that only they have or maybe one other person has. So that's kind of what we specialize in. And, you know, it may not be business savvy to the nth degree, like we're not making 100,000 cases of Pinot Grigio and, you know, flogging them all over New York, but the customers that get wine from us are kind of believing the same stuff we do, which is supporting these small farms, supporting these young winemakers who have a passion for doing it. And we supply them with a market and we allow them to get their product out there to otherwise an untapped group of people.
Welcome to this afternoon's program At the Root of It. This is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, with an opening from our sponsor today, Barterhouse Wines. It's the 28th of September, and we are broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network in Bushwick, Brooklyn, at Roberta's Restaurant in the backyard. And before I introduce my guest this afternoon, Sandy Block, Master of Wine and VP of Beverage Operations from Legal Seafoods, he'll be calling in. I'm going to start with the Week in Wine recap. And in latest news, the new Cru Bourgeois selection has been announced in Paris and London after 3 years of work. The Alliance has made clear that the listing is an annual quality assessment, not a classification of chateau or terroir like the 1855 classification. The original Cru Bourgeois classification had been mired in controversy since it was updated in 2003, when it was annulled after 78 producers bitterly contested their exclusion. For the new classification, a panel made up of paid wine professionals, but no chateau owners, selected benchmark wines, which set the quality standard for all the 290 wines which applied for Cru Bourgeois status, reports Decanter.com. The benchmark, what constitutes the minimum level of acceptability for a Cru Bourgeois, is adjusted every year according to vintage quality. Thus, in a poor vintage, the number of labels is expected to drop. Any chateau can apply to be a Cru Bourgeois. All wines are retasted between March and July every year for the new listing. And wines are tasted in barrel with the percentage retasted after bottling in anonymous shelf tests or when the wines are chosen from random at retailer shelves. It's also been made clear there'll be no special cuvées in the listing. However, it is doubtful that the classification will remain in its present state for more than a few vintages, as there will probably be a vote for member chateau to decide on whether to reinstate some sort of hierarchy within the listing. This would be welcome to some of the higher-end crews. And in the crop report earlier this month, Piedmont winemakers and Moscato grape growers initiated a protest against bottlers, and they finally reached an accord this week after 9 hours of negotiation. The new two-year contract brought higher prices for grape growers and helped to bolster their security by establishing new guidelines for yields and by limiting the amount of wine Spumante producers can reserve at any given time. Bottlers often reserve wine to be bottled and shipped as demand increases. Bottlers would have preferred to pay more for higher quality grapes instead of paying a fixed rate for the entire harvest, but the growers have come to a happy conclusion with this. And in the market report, Sotheby's Auction House has bought out Alden Cellars, the retail wine store on the ground floor of its headquarters on the upscale Upper East Side. The new redesigned shop is called Sotheby's Wine, and it's the first of its kind for the company. In 2008, it had bought out Alden Cellars, planning to sell fine wine at retail. When Sotheby's began its wine auctions in 1994, New York state law required that standalone auction houses that wanted to deal in rare and fine wine had to partner with the store that had held a liquor license for 10 years. Sotheby's first partner was Sherry Lehman, and that relationship ended in 1999. And at that point, Sotheby's found another licensee, and the resulting store was named Alden Cellars. If the Manhattan store is successful, it may open Sotheby's wine stores elsewhere in the U.S. Christie's, a principal competitor in Manhattan, whose wine auctions are carried out as New York Wine Christie's, remains affiliated with a wine store called the New York Wine Warehouse. And as I mentioned, after this short break, we'll be back with my guest this afternoon, Sandy Block, who will be calling in from the road. You are listening to At the Root of It, and this is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick. And a thank you again to our sponsor, Barterhouse Wines, and to our producer today, Jack Ainsley, and engineer, Nat Wiener. As I mentioned just before the break, I have Sandy Block, Master of Wine, one of the only 279 Masters of Wine worldwide, and also the VP of Beverage Operations for Legal Seafood since 2004, and who has recently created a wine location specialist certificate program in collaboration with the CIVC, the Comité Interprofessionnel du Vin du Chapin, and the IVDP, Instituto dos Vinos de Porto e Douro, and two organizations which we've spoken about in the past. So without further ado, I'm going to welcome Sandy Block to the phone. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for your time. I know you're on the road today.
I'm pleased to speak to your guests, to speak to your audience about the Center for Wine Origins. I appreciate your having me on. This is something that kind of means a lot to me since these are two of my favorite regions in the world.
And just to back up, we're talking about which regions here?
Champagne and the Douro,
yeah.
Where port is produced.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, they're both incredibly beautiful. And very distinctive and unique in terms of their terroir and their landscape. And they're also two of the most imitated names in the wine world. And for that reason, the Center for Wine Origins decided to launch this campaign, which was essentially to give people an accreditation to go out there and teach and educate others about the unique characteristics that make these wines so special.
Mm-hmm.
So my role in this was putting together the educational piece and creating an exam based on a study guide that I wrote. And have you seen the study guide?
Only briefly, actually, yeah.
Oh, okay. It's actually something that is focused on the trade, so it's not for consumers,
mm-hmm.
but sommeliers, beverage directors, chefs. We have some wine school directors and retailers across the country. And it's an online exam that you take once you apply to the center. And we have about 100 people registered to, including some really leading people in the industry, which I'm excited about.
Great.
Registered to take the first exam. So
the first exam is coming up then in a couple weeks, right?
I believe it's October 8th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you officially launch this certificate program?
Well, the program was launched about 2 months ago.
Oh, okay. So very new.
Yeah.
And for our listeners, too, I think it's worthwhile to mention that the Center for Wine Origins was essentially created between these two regions to protect the name of Champagne and the Douro as well, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of the sparkling wine that's sold in the United States is labeled champagne, and as I'm sure your listeners are aware, only wine that's produced in the Champagne region in northern France really should be entitled to use that name because it's a geographic place name.
Mm-hmm.
So this was partly to clear up that confusion and to spread more information about what the real characteristics of Champagne are. And port is also misused. We'll see it on the labels of wines from places outside of the Douro. So, and it's kind of ironic because actually the Douro and the name Porto was the first legally protected name back in the 18th century because the wine became so instantaneously popular
mm-hmm.
on export markets that other wines from Portugal were kind of fraudulently taking on that name so that they would be easier to sell. So it makes sense that the Instituto de Vinho de Porto would be one of the leading organizations in this effort to protect the name because it's part of their heritage.
Yeah, so that history really has documented, and this is the following segue to continue to educate the trade and then hence the consumers about the history and about the just the quality that you can get from these particular regions that otherwise could be mislead consumers or mislead the trade if it's not clarified.
Yeah, absolutely. That's in a nutshell is exactly what we're hoping to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you see, given the old world and how Champagne and Port, for instance, are two of the oldest wine producing regions in the world, other regions also wanting to form something similar?
It could possibly attract other regions such as Burgundy, because obviously the names of Chablis, Burgundy itself are taken and used in a sort of misleading way by some wine producers. But I think with Champagne and with Port, they're actually types of wine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the confusion is there because people assume anything with bubbles is going to be Champagne because that's what a lot of companies have marketed. And anything with high alcohol and kind of dark and red is going to be port. So they're probably the most logical ones to have instituted this. But I think that if we recognize the uniqueness of these wines and why they could only be produced in these regions in the authentic version, then I think that that's the primary object of this particular campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, as a wine lover, one of the things that attracted me to this originally was that everything that you taste in the world is different based upon its unique growing conditions and the culture and the climate of where it originates. So I want there to be as much diversity as possible. I think it makes it as interesting, really interesting to be in this field because there is so much diversity. So I don't want to kind of collapse things. I think there are great sparkling wines made all over the world.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, we just shouldn't call them champagne because that's confusing everyone.
Well, I think the efforts that have already been taken have certainly caught on because it does seem that the people that I speak to in my day-to-day have a pretty clear understanding that champagne is only from Champagne, at least in my microclimate of New York.
So I think people are pretty hip in New York.
Yeah.
I'm sure that most of the people that you're in contact with are aware of it as most of the people I am. But
yeah.
it's that large segment of the population that's really has a sort of hazy or less of a deep interest in wine that gets confused by it. So that's mm-hmm. what this is hopefully going to address by creating a large number of people who are qualified to really talk about the origins and what's so different about them.
So for the trade then, given that this particular certificate program is really geared towards trade, as further study, what would this mean for those in the industry after they've completed it?
Well, I think, you know, you'll be listed on this on the website of the Center for Wine Origins. You'll feel a sense of accomplishment and completion. That the exam's not easy, I will say that. You know, it's not intentionally hard, but it's just, you know, we want to make sure that if people are certified that they really know their stuff, mm-hmm. and they can really connect the dots and are really able to go out and teach it and be able to educate people. So, you know, there'll be that sense of satisfaction having passed a difficult exam, and also, you know, having a listing on the website so that if people are looking to hire somebody to do a tasting, especially of champagne and port, obviously, you know, your name will be out there.
So it's as much about education as it is about creating a network of ambassadors to help spread the word.
Yeah, I think the two go hand in hand, but yeah. The education piece is really the critical one.
Sure. So I imagine, as you just mentioned, that it's possible to register on the Center for Wine Origins website if anyone in the trade wants to take this exam.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an application. It's just www.wineorigins.com. It's W-I-N-E, origins.com. The application is there, or, you know, the first test, again, will be October 8th, but there will be, I think, a test once every quarter or every 4 months. So, yeah, anyone can get information about it and then get an application. And, again, I'm not 100% sure exactly what the criteria are for being approved to take the exam, but there's something, you know, related to the amount of experience that you have and you know, certainly involvement as a specialist in the trade in some form or another in those areas that I mentioned. It could also be culinary, too, because, you know, our chefs are getting much more educated about wine and spirits as well.
Absolutely,
So we'd love to have culinary people, because there is a culinary component to the study guide that I put together too. We do talk about wine and food matching, uh-huh. and the various styles of champagne and styles of port and how appropriate or not they are for different types of food. So yeah, the first step would be to register, get an application, and you know, and then take it from there. I always advise people in these types of authentication or certification programs to take as much time as you need.
Right.
It's, you know, everyone starts with a different level of expertise, different level of comfort with the various aspects of understanding wine. So I do have a lot of information in there that's maybe about viticulture and vinification that may be a little bit foreign to people if they haven't studied it, but, you know, all the information is there. Other people feel more adept at that, and there are other aspects that they need to brush up on. You know, we want everyone who takes it to pass it.
Yeah, exactly. Given your experience studying for the Master of Wine, which one can take at their own comfort level over a period of time, did that sort of course study have an influence on the way that you wrote this particular certificate program?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's had an influence on everything that I do professionally. But yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a different kind of exam. There's also blind tasting involved in it. I'm talking about the Master Wine exam, blind tasting and essay writing. There is a little bit of an essay that we're asking people to write, mm-hmm. on this exam, but it's not as involved as you know, writing lengthy essays.
Yeah.
But yeah, the concept of how you learn and what the important things are, that influences everything that I do. Absolutely.
And then in terms of the study guide, did you include any new ideas for wine study differently than maybe current programs that sommeliers are being certified under?
Yeah, I think it's pretty unique. Because it's very, very focused on these two areas. So we start off with more general definitions of terroir, then we get into the cultural aspects of how these wines evolved and the historical aspects of how they evolved. And then we break it down a little bit into the characteristics that you would expect based upon the soil, the climate, and then the culture. And I think it's a slightly different take than any program that I've seen. I'd love you to take a look at it and let me know what you think, because it's actually, and I had nothing to do with this except to recommend the graphics. The the center put together an absolutely incredibly graphic and beautiful book that illustrates the points I'm making in very dramatic terms on the visual side.
Well, so, I imagine that I'm going to get friendly with it, because I would like to sign up for this certificate program myself.
Oh, outstanding. Yeah. Outstanding. I think you'll find it worthwhile.
Great. Well, please stay on the line. We're going to take a short break, but I'd like to come back to speak a little bit more about port and the cork industry as well. You are listening to At the Root of It. This is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, with my guest on the line today, Sandy Block, who, as I mentioned before the break, has recently created a wine location specialist certificate program. That is a lot to say in one sentence.
It's a tongue twister.
Yeah, it is. It is. I want to go a little bit into port, because I've noticed just in the past year or so, there's been a specific efforts being made not only by the cork industry with a new push to slow the momentum of synthetic alternatives to natural cork, but also in ways that port can maybe appeal to a younger generation, whether that be through cocktails or as an aperitif. So first of all, I wanted to just kind of clarify what in your mind makes port wine so unique from other aperitifs made in similar methods.
Well, I mean, one trip to the region, or if you haven't seen pictures of it, you know, looking through this brochure, this book that we put together, kind of answers the question. These are the steepest hills that I've ever been on where wine is made.
Mm-hmm.
Terraces are very, very narrow. You have this incredibly beautiful winding river that the vineyards go down to, that when you're on one part of the river, you don't see another part of it, and you see virtually no signs of modern life. You know, you see little hills and lodges, houses and lodges dotted around the hills. So it's really, really rocky soil, schist soil, on these incredibly steep hillsides that have virtually no maritime influence once you get into the Cimacorgo. The area around Pinhal. And so what you get there is these incredibly ripe grapes and intense flavors, really, really dark colors. But one of the tricks with port is you're only macerating it for a couple of days at most.
Mm-hmm.
It's unlike a Cabernet Sauvignon or, you know, a red wine. You have to take it off the skins quickly in order to finish to stop the fermentation with the spirit. So you have to figure out ways of getting a lot of the color and flavor into the wine prior even to fermentation or in the early stages of fermentation. So and I think there's a great picture of it in the brochure. Booklet. It's still an area where, for at least some wines, they tread the grapes. They actually stomp on the grapes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
it's really an area where you can go back in time. I mean, you feel like it's 19th century when you're in the Douro.
Yeah, so it's super special.
Yeah, in terms of uniqueness, I mean, yeah, you can fortify wine anywhere. You can grow Zinfandel grapes in the Central Valley of California and get them up to nice ripe, 16% or 17% potential alcohol. Stop the fermentation by adding brandy, but you know it's going to be a different flavor. It's going to be a different feel.
Yeah,
it's different.
And then for its characteristics as an aperitif. I mean, I know there's port that comes in many different styles, and I imagine that differently from champagne in terms of just learning the styles and learning about the specificities of port, it's probably harder to learn in terms of its aging process and different styles for the regular consumer or even in the trade. It's a chapter you really need to get friendly with to understand all the different styles.
Yeah, there's so much variety there. I would say with aperitifs, there are some dry white ports. They haven't really caught on in this country.
No.
There are some sweet white ports, which are delicious, which also haven't caught on outside of the specific Portuguese ethnic community. They call them Lagrim ports. And in France, you know, France is the largest consumer of port. They consume a ton of tawny port, basic young tawny port, chilled as an aperitif.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have, you know, very, very few people in the U.S. drink sweet aperitifs.
That's true, yeah.
It's a really refreshing, really delicious delicious way to start a meal, but it really hasn't caught on in the United States. So, I don't know, in terms of an aperitif, it's still really, I would say, in the infancy stages in the United States. Most people are going to drink port after dinner, with either cheese or chocolate. Being a chocoholic like myself, to me, it's the ideal chocolate.
Yeah, you
company.
Can attest to that, as can I. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and probably a few people listening in.
Yeah.
If you really have a thing for chocolate, there's a port for every type of chocolate.
Nice.
So I really like the tawnies with the more milk chocolatey flavors, and then, you know, that real bittersweet chocolate with the LBV or even vintage or single quinta port.
Well, I just returned last week from Jerez and Sherry Country, and I know that there's more people in the trade utilizing sherry in cocktails, and I just wondered maybe if you thought port might see similar, usage.
I think there could be.
Yeah.
I think maybe sherry may lend itself to it a little bit more, particularly with the floor-based sherries because of that higher acid, more of a cut, than it has. I have to say I'm pretty much of a purist when it comes to port. I don't like mixing it. I know a lot of people do, and that's fine. I don't really like mixing it or chilling it myself.
Uh-huh.
I do like it pretty much in the traditional way.
Sure.
After dinner.
And then one last question, which I wanted to touch upon before we close today, just in regards to the cork industry, and I know that so much of the forests in Portugal are being, used, or there's a campaign to save the forest by continuing to save the cork industry. So I think that more education is needed in regards to that campaign, as opposed to just kind of an advertising effort, but wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, it's enormously complicated. On the one hand, cork is obviously a natural product that regenerates itself, and these forests in the Alentejo they've been kept alive. Not only through the cork industry, there are other uses to the cork oak.
Sure.
Not only for wines, but on the other hand, I think we still have a problem where there's a percentage of wines that are tainted, and for wines that are not destined for long aging, it's generally a consensus among people that I know that they're going to be fresher and cleaner and less marred by potential problems if you use one of the alternatives, in particular the stove enclosure.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, cork, I don't think cork is ever going away, but I think it will see a diminished role because it's still, you know, I don't know whether it's 2% or 3% of bottles are tainted in one degree or another through TCA. And the insidious part of it is that very often people don't know that they're tainted. They just think that the wine isn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But missing a little bit of vibrancy. And it's just not the way that the producer intended it to be.
Sure.
But I think for those reasons, cork is going to play a more diminished role in the future. Until they figure out a way perhaps to sterilize the cork without stimulating the growth of TCA in a small number of cases, the industry is going to continue to turn toward this.
Well, it certainly will be something interesting to watch, but I do agree with you and your sentiments. Well, before we close, can you point our listeners to the website to gather more information regarding the certificate program?
Absolutely. It's, again, www.wineorigins, WineOrigins.com, and all the information that you need to get involved in this program are right on that website. And I invite anyone who's in the trade to check it out, because even if it's not something you decide you want to tackle now, it's something you should be aware of.
Yeah.
And there's really other good information on the site as well about the relationship between a wine's origins and the characteristics of the wine.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Sandy. It was a pleasure having you on today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, cheers.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And a thank you again to our sponsor today, Barterhouse Wines, and to our trusty engineer, Nat Wiener, and amazing producer, Jack Inslee. I won't see you next week because I'll be at jury duty, but catch up with you the next week after. Thanks for listening.